about spinning off Fox and buying it through a separate company. So there's a lot of maneuvers that, remain to be seen.
So
that's a reality.
As we wrap, when you look at News of the World, one of the oldest tabloids in Britain, it closed. Murdoch closed it almost overnight after it was just a wash in scandal. You have Michael Wolff, who just wrote a biography of Rupert Murdoch, who told Vanity Fair, speaking about Fox, "I think it will cease to exist in the present form." Do you see that possibly happening? I mean, could Fox be sold off, what, to someone like Elon Musk, right? He'll drop FO and it'll just be X.
Yeah, I do think that Fox News in its current form will no longer exist, and we're starting to see that happen. You know, most recently, with the First Republican debate, typically Fox is the sole media partner, and yet they didn't have streaming rights to it this time. They shared that with an online sort of YouTube alternative called Rumble that the RNC sanctioned. That would have been unheard of in previous elections because there wasn't a counterbalance to Fox. For the last 25 years, Fox News and Rush Limbaugh were the center of gravity amongst the massive right-wing media echo chamber. They were the conductor for this chorus. And right now, the right-wing media is a chorus without a conductor. They don't exert the same influence that they had. Their ratings are down. The business fundamentals are changing, and so they don't really have a plan for what happens on the other side of all these changes in consumption habits. The one thing that isn't going to change, and it really was just determined the speed at which Fox sort of declines, is what happens with these cable fights. About 70% of Fox's revenue is actually up for grabs right now because they're trying to renew their contracts with all these cable companies. They're trying to get massive increases in what cable companies pay them. If they're successful at doing that, then Fox News will look and feel the same for at least the next 6 years. If they're not as successful, then Fox will start to adjust and weaken even faster because they won't be a profitable company anymore, which would have never been conceivable even 6 months ago that Fox News would not be profitable. So I do agree that consumption habits, the changes in the landscape, and for the first time ever, they're not really sitting at the center of gravity. That could be worse for all of us because it depends on who comes in. The right-wing landscape right now is bloodthirsty, but it also could mean that they never get another conductor. And a right-wing media only is powerful when it functions as an echo chamber. If it doesn't have a conductor, then it's just noise, and you can't really operationalize noise. That's been the real power of Fox, that it was able to operationalize that media apparatus and really create that echo, which you then could reverberate through the rest of the media, through culture, and leverage it for power and change.
Angela Carasone, I want to thank you for being with us, president of Media Matters, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Next up, President Biden's invited the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to the White House after the two met on the sidelines of the U.N. General Assembly. Critics say Biden is now embracing Israel's apartheid system. Stay with us. Be Friends by War. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Protesters are planning to gather today outside the United Nations, where Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is scheduled to address the UN General Assembly. On Wednesday, President Biden met with Netanyahu on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly in their first meeting since Netanyahu returned to office in December as head of the most right-wing government in Israeli history. Biden reportedly invited Netanyahu to the White House for a future meeting. In recent months, the Biden administration's criticized the gutting of the judiciary by Netanyahu's far-right government and its expansion of illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. But the Biden administration continues to send Israel $3.8 billion in annual military funding to help Israel run what many human rights groups describe as an apartheid state. So far this year, Israeli forces have killed at least 240 Palestinians, including six on Tuesday, the day before Biden and Netanyahu met. This is President Biden speaking as their meeting began.
We're going to discuss some of the hard issues, and that is upholding democratic values that lie at the heart of our partnership, including checks and balances in our systems, and preserving a path to a negotiated two-state solution, and ensuring that Iran never, never acquires a nuclear weapon. Because even where we have some differences, my commitment to Israel, as you know, is ironclad. I think without Israel, there's not a Jew in the world that's secure. I think Israel is essential.
During the meeting, President Biden also pushed for Israel to reach a deal to fully normalize relations with Saudi Arabia. Today's protest against Netanyahu is scheduled for 4 p.m. outside the United Nations. A key organizer of that demonstration is Jewish Voice for Peace. Beth Miller, the political director of JVP Action, spoke to Democracy Now!
This morning, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is going to be addressing the United Nations General Assembly. And he's going to be attempting to justify his government's violence and racism against Palestinians. And he's almost certainly going to falsely claim that his government's brutality against Palestinians somehow protects Jews. That is simply not true. So today, the New York City chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace is taking to the streets in front of the UN to protest Netanyahu and Israel's apartheid government. Right now, the Israeli government is demolishing Palestinian homes, throwing Palestinian children into military prisons, locking millions of people in Gaza under military blockade. So we're going to be making it clear that no leaders of this government, including Netanyahu, are welcome in New York City. More importantly, that it's time for the U.S. government to end the flow of $3.8 billion every single year to the Israeli military.
We're joined now by two guests. Alex Keynes, a senior reporter for Jewish Currents. His new piece is titled Biden's Legacy Will Be Apartheid. And Yusuf Munayir is a Palestinian-American analyst, head of the Israel-Palestine program at Arab Center, Washington, D.C. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Alex Keynes, let's begin with you. That title, Biden's Legacy Will Be Apartheid. Yet many would say that Biden has been critical of this, what many describe as Israel's most far-right government in its history. Talk about how the significance of this meeting with Netanyahu this week and inviting him to the White House.
Thanks, Amy. So the meeting at the UN General Assembly was notable for where it was not. It was not at the White House, and that was taken in Israel and the United States as a rebuke of Netanyahu for pursuing a far-right agenda to gut the power of the Israeli judiciary, which Biden is very concerned with because Biden sees Israel as a fellow liberal democracy. So the fact that the meeting took place at the UN General Assembly rather than at the White House was a sort of symbolic rebuke. And Biden's State Department has issued many, many, many statements of condemnation of Israel's plans in the West Bank when they build illegal settlements and legalize outposts that were previously under Israeli law illegal, and as well as kill Palestinians, including Palestinian Americans. The State Department has repeatedly told Israel to calm down the situation in the West Bank. But these are merely symbolic rebukes. The Biden administration has refused to even think about conditioning U.S. military aid to Israel on respect for Palestinian human rights. They have shielded the country from pressure at the United Nations over its illegal settlements and have continued to stress the importance of the U.S.-Israel alliance. So we should be clear that that Biden is deeply uncomfortable with this far-right Israeli government because it has an agenda at odds with how Biden conceives of Israel. But he continues to support Israel with money and diplomatic support. And so when Biden says his support for Israel is ironclad, it basically means that his support for Israel is unconditional, even as it consolidates an apartheid rule in the occupied territories and escalates ethnic cleansing processes that are going on right now.
And the issue of Saudi Arabia, when Joe Biden ran for president, he said he would make MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, a pariah for the assassination of the Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi, among other human rights issues. But now the U.S. pushing for normalization of relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, Biden believes that the fundamental root of the sort of conflict in the Middle East that Israel is involved with is Arab rejection of Israel as a Jewish state. And so as a result, he's doubling down on Trump-era normalization deals known as the Abraham Accords, in which Israel, in exchange for dropping plans to declare annexation of the West Bank, Israel normalized ties with the United Arab Emirates, as well as Bahrain, Morocco. And so when Biden came in, he decided to pursue this. And now with Saudi Arabia, he's looking to basically bring Israel, Saudi Arabia together with some serious U.S. guarantees of there's talk of a U.S. defense treaties with both Saudi Arabia and Israel, which would bind the U.S. to sort of come to the defense of these two repressive countries. And really what the Abraham Accords will do, there's a lot of talk of, you know, how this will help the Palestinians, who are, of course, under a brutal military occupation. But what Saudi normalization with Israel would do at U.S. with U.S. help would be to further isolate and marginalize Palestinians. And so it's not going to help regional peace. It's just going to further consolidate Israeli apartheid, this time with the blessing of the most important Muslim state in the region.
Let's bring Yusuf Munayyer into this conversation, Palestinian-American, as they met on the sidelines of the U.N. General Assembly. That's Biden and Netanyahu. This was just a day after six Palestinians were killed by Israeli forces. Can you talk about the significance of this? That's among about 240 Palestinians who've been killed by Israeli forces so far this year.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Amy. That's correct. You know, in 2022, last year, the United Nations noted that it was the single deadliest year for Palestinians in the West Bank being killed by the Israeli military in nearly two decades of them keeping track of those numbers. And the pace that we are seeing for 2023 looks to far go over the numbers from the record-setting year the year before. I think, you know, if we're to describe the Biden administration as in any way critical of the Israeli government and Netanyahu in particular, we really need to put that kind of criticism in perspective and in the context, the extreme context, which we are seeing on the ground of unprecedented violence against Palestinians on a daily basis, not just being carried out by the Israeli military, which, you know, as you noted, has been accused by various human rights organizations, Palestinian, Israeli, and international human rights organizations, of committing the crime of apartheid, but also violence against Palestinians at the hands of Israeli settlers who are running amok in the West Bank, feeling a sense of support from an extremist government in ways that they have never felt before, and really conducting attacks on Palestinians with a sense of impunity, and all of this is happening alongside, of course, this Israeli government attempting a massive legislative power grab to ensure that right-wing forces in Israel remain in power in Israel for years to come. And so while we've heard some mild criticism from the Biden administration, particularly around these judicial issues, that criticism does not match the extreme situation on the ground. And in fact, it seems completely ignorant of the very dangerous realities. Couple that with the fact that the Biden administration is also doing for Netanyahu things that other administrations have not been willing or able to do before. This American administration is racing towards granting Israel entry into the U.S. visa waiver program, something that Israel has sought for many years that the Biden administration seems willing to bend over backwards to accommodate, even if it means accepting the discrimination of Palestinian Americans traveling into and through Israeli-controlled borders. It's also working on providing Netanyahu now with perhaps his biggest political achievement in normalizing ties with Saudi Arabia. When one considers the degree of severity of the situation on the ground, the rampant violence against Palestinians, the way this extreme right-wing government is dedicated to annexation and destroying any possibilities of peace, and then puts that alongside what this administration is actually doing, it's hard to think of this administration as any way critical, but rather providing full-throated support for continued apartheid.
Do you see a difference in concrete ways between the Biden policy towards Israel and Trump's policy towards Israel?
You know, in some ways, the Biden administration policy is worse because I think it it's more hypocritical. With Trump, you had this ethno-nationalist approach that was at least in harmony with what the Israelis were trying to do and what other right-wing leaders across the world were trying to do. With the Biden administration, you have language about human rights being at the center of foreign policy, but the reality is completely different. You see this not just with Israel, of course, but with Saudi Arabia, that the administration is normalizing its relations with. After calling them a pariah a few years ago. You see that as well with India, which has just been accused of a gruesome act of transnational repression in neighboring Canada. And many people have been outspoken and criticizing the human rights violations of the Modi regime in India that the Biden administration welcomed with a red carpet here for a state visit earlier this year. So the Biden administration, you hear talk about human rights, you hear talk about democracy, but the reality is quite the contrary. And I think that hypocrisy is what separates the most from Donald Trump, because, you know, you knew what you were getting with Donald Trump, and he was quite honest about it. And with the Biden administration, you hear talk about democracy, but the reality is that they're supporting apartheid and authoritarianism in many places around the globe.
Very quickly, Alex Kane, you're a senior reporter for Jewish Currents. Do you see Jewish public opinion in the United States shifting around Israel and the occupation of the Palestinian territories?
Yes, particularly amongst young people, but not just young people. People are waking up, and particularly now as Netanyahu's extremist government puts on display a shocking level of violence. We have over 1,000 Palestinians that have been displaced this year, their villages literally wiped off the map. Young American Jews, and I think many other, even not just young American Jews, are waking up and seeing this, but that is not being reflected in the organized American Jewish establishment, which continues to lobby the U.S. government to support Israel as it does. So the sort of there's a real gap between Jewish public opinion and what the organized American Jewish community is telling the Biden administration to do.
Alex Kane, I want to thank you for being with us, senior reporter for Jewish Currents. We'll link to your piece, Biden's Legacy Will Be Apartheid, and Yusuf Munayir, Palestinian-American analyst, head of the Israel-Palestine program at Arab Center, Washington, D.C. Next up, we speak with California Congressmember Ro Khanna, as Republican infighting could soon lead to a government shutdown and more. Back in 30 seconds. Children of the Grave by Black Sabbath. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Congress and the shutdown showdown. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy's accused right-wing extremists in the House of wanting to, quote, burn the whole place down after a handful of Republican hardliners rebelled and blocked a Pentagon spending bill. It's become increasingly likely the federal government will shut down October 1st because fighting within the Republican caucus has prevented McCarthy from being able to pass any spending bills. On Thursday, McCarthy sent lawmakers home for an extended weekend. This is House Speaker McCarthy talking to reporters Thursday after the latest setback.
It's frustrating in the sense that I don't understand why anybody votes against bringing the idea and having the debate. And then you've got all the amendments if you don't like the bill. This is a whole new concept of individuals that just want to burn the whole place down. That doesn't work.
We're joined now from the Kennan Rotunda in Washington, D.C. by Democratic Congressmember Ro Khanna to talk about the possible shutdown, as well as the UAW strike and other issues. Congressmember, welcome back to Democracy Now! So what does this shutdown mean if it were to happen? And talk about whether you think House Speaker McCarthy is going to lose his position as Speaker.
Amy, it's chaos here. The sad thing is it has a real impact on Americans. If you need a Social Security check or you need something from the government, now it's a 35-minute wait time. It could be hours wait time to get anyone if the government shuts down. Our military would not get paid if we cannot pass a defense appropriation bill. Millions of workers in the federal government wouldn't get paid. Now, they may get back pay, but if someone is living on $50,000, $60,000, how are they going to pay rent? How are they going to pay mortgage? So it is highly irresponsible. Just this morning, we finally have one Republican, Mike Lawler, saying that he may side with Democrats, sign a discharge petition to get the government funded. If we can get five or six reasonable Republicans to do that, we can avert this crisis. But McCarthy has just failed to do the most basic function of a Speaker of the House, keep the government open and functioning.
What does it mean when the government shuts down? Explain who gets affected right off October 1st.
Well, all the federal workers get affected. As I pointed out, military personnel would not be paid. You would not get pay if you're a federal employee. This will impact the level of services that people get at the parks. It'll impact the level of services they get if you need a Social Security check or you need a government assistance for anything. It will impact our immigration services at a time where the Republicans are screaming, saying that we are not processing immigration cases fast enough. This would slow that down. So it would just be a total self-inflicted injury that would make life much harder for ordinary Americans, particularly for people who serve in our military or in the federal government in any way.
You talk about the military. You also have what's going on in the Senate right now with the Alabama former football coach, now Senator Tuberville, stopping the confirmation of top military officials. Explain how that works in coupling with the surprise that House Republican members are no longer supporting funding the military.
Well, look, to the extent that there are some House Republicans who are against the bloated Pentagon budget of $1 trillion, I welcome that. I mean, I interviewed or questioned Lockheed Martin CEO about 40% profits on the Patriot system, and we definitely need accountability and strategic cuts in the defense contractor profits. The problem is you can't just stop funding our military and stop paying the troops. And that's what the extreme Republicans are for. And you can't do what Senator Tuberville is doing, which is hold up the appointment of senior military leaders and officials. That is hurting the morale of the military. And if there were ever a conflict, it hurts our readiness. It's highly irresponsible. And to my knowledge, no senator has ever done that before, holding up senior military appointments. It shows the need for systematic reform of the United States Senate.
Congressmember Khanna, let's talk about the historic United Auto Workers strike, which just marked a week since some, well, close to 13,000 auto workers walked off the job. Ahead of the strike, you co-authored an op-ed in The Guardian with UAW President Sean Fain, where you wrote, quote, "The climate crisis and income inequality are the two greatest challenges facing our generation. This is a pivotal moment for the American economy and the workers that make it run. Corporations are pushing hard to use this moment to expand their power. We're mobilizing for a new model that puts working people, climate justice, and human rights before profit." You and the UAW President Sean Fain wrote. If you can talk about this and President, former President Trump now heading to Detroit, he's attacking the UAW leadership, but saying he's supporting the workers, but going to try to drive a sort of wedge around the issue of electric vehicles and saying this kind of climate change approach will make workers lose jobs.
Amy, Sean Fain is an American hero. He's not just speaking out for UAW. He's speaking out for what the working class has wanted for the last four decades. That's what I heard on the picket lines when I was out with UAW members in Wayne, Michigan, and in Toledo, Ohio. I mean, what Sean is saying is these CEOs are making $30 million, 300 to 1, the median worker wage. That is up from 20 to 1 in the 1960s. These big three auto companies are making $21 billion in profits. They are taking that money and putting $5 billion in buying their own stock to enrich their shareholders. And yet for workers, many of them are not whole from the cuts they had in 2008, where they voluntarily agreed to reduce their salaries because of the Great Recession. They still have not been made whole for that. It is wrong. It's a symptom of the gross income inequality in this country. And Sean Fain is finally standing up to it. He's going to win. There is now two sides to this. They should agree to the increases that Sean Fain wants. In many cases, that's just going to bring people up to the 2008 levels if they're temporary or part-time workers. And I believe Donald Trump is just demagoguing the issue. His view that we should not have electric vehicles means that all those electric vehicles would be produced in China. Of course, we want to make sure that those electric vehicles are produced in the United States, not in China. And we want to make sure that those jobs are good union jobs. That's what Sean Fain and UAW are fighting for.
Hakeem Jeffries walked the picket line. Do you think President Biden should? What do you feel about your colleague, Congressmember Debbie Dingell, who represents the Ford, the workers at the Ford plant that is on strike, saying that Biden should keep his distance?
Well, I thought Hakeem did a great job, and Catherine Clark coming out. I'd love to see other members of Congress go out to the picket line. It would be good for President Biden to come out either to a union hall. He could go out to UAW Local 900 or to a picket line. I know the logistics are hard. I think what Congresswoman Debbie Dingell meant is that the president and his team shouldn't intervene in the negotiations. The UAW has the upper hand. We should strengthen that hand and side with them and not try to preempt their negotiation in having a deal that doesn't get what the workers really need.
Congressmember Khanna, you serve as co-chair of the Congressional Caucus on India and Indian Americans. Can you talk about this growing dispute between Canada and India after the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau publicly accused Narendra Modi and the Indian government of assassinating a Canadian Sikh leader shot dead outside his temple in June? Canadian officials told AP Trudeau's claim was based in part on surveillance of Indian diplomats inside Canada collected by Five Eyes Intelligence Sharing Alliance. Can you respond to the allegation against Modi?
Well, there are, of course, very serious allegations, and I echo what Jake Sullivan and our State Department have said, that the United States needs to cooperate in a transparent investigation, and we expect a transparent investigation, and then whoever the perpetrators are to be brought to justice. But there has to be full transparency, and there has to be all the facts that come out. And obviously, they're very serious allegations. And I do think that Jake Sullivan and the State Department are taking it seriously.
California Congressmember Ro Khanna, we thank you so much. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Standing up against racism is an ongoing battle. How will you help? I will always speak out against bigotry and hatred when I see it.
I will put my passion into action. I will stand against racist words and action and speak out against hate when I see it. Hate has no place in Canada.
I will continue to honor, express, and promote my Indigenous culture.
This message is brought to you by the Canadian Anti-Racism Youth Coalition. Visit caryc.ca for more information about how you can stand up and speak out.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.